Democrats have to make to win that. Numbers still suggest it's doable or even likely, but we can't just rest on our laurels. And sadly, the impact of right-wing media, which is why we need background briefing, which is level-headed for real people. Everybody gets it, and it gives great information every day. So call in, pledge support, 818-985-5735, $125 pledge of support for Tad Devine's brand new, super important book on the Bernie Sanders campaign from 2016. Okay, Ian Masters, man, you know, get people to listen to this show. Everybody should know about this. Have them tune in on this radio station 5 days a week, available across the world digitally.
And I think everybody who donated today in this second day of KPFK's Summer Fun Drive, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another background briefing. Bye for now.
KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Good evening. It's Wednesday, July 22nd. This is the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Civilian infrastructure deliberately targeted by both sides in the war in Iran.
Iran's in a lot of trouble.
Despite the unpopularity of the war, the House of Representatives passes two military spending measures to further fund the war and other things.
Tens of billion dollars for the Pentagon. Billions more for the CIA to continue funding this illegal war.
Arizona's election primary results are in.
And as we unite and we go out and we work super hard, I have every bit of confidence that we're going to win.
And New York's progressive mayor Zoran Mamdani says he doesn't have the authority to arrest Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Benjamin Netanyahu is a war criminal. The architect of a horrific genocide against the Palestinians.
These stories and more are coming up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, this is the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Mitch Jezerich. The U.S. military has announced that it is conducting another night of strikes against Iran. U.S. Central Command said Wednesday the strikes are designed to further degrade Iran's ability to threaten civilian mariners and commercial vessels transiting regional waters as U.S. pushes to regain control over the Strait of Hormuz and restore the flow of international shipping. U.S. President Donald Trump warned earlier Wednesday that the United States will destroy one bridge or power plant each time Iran shoots at a ship in the strait. Lauren Schmidt has this summary.
President Trump is once again threatening civilian infrastructure in Iran, warning that the United States will destroy a bridge or power plant each time Iran fires at a ship in the Strait of Hormuz. Trump issued his latest threat today as the deeply unpopular war continues to escalate, with no clear diplomatic off-ramp, raising the risk of further disruption to the global economy. As the Strait of Hormuz remains largely closed amid Iranian attacks and ongoing disputes over control of the waterway, the United States carried out a wave of strikes across Iran overnight into Wednesday, while air defenses opened fire over Tehran. Iran also launched a missile attack towards a Jordanian city near the Israeli border, as alerts were issued in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia. Secretary of State Marco Rubio provided this update to reporters.
Here's what's happening. It's pretty straightforward. Ships are trying to go through the straits and they're getting blown up. Commercial ships are going through the straits and they're being blown up. The United States is defending that shipping and in addition is targeting the places that are launching against those ships to continue to degrade Iran's ability to target and harm global shipping.
Speaking from the Oval Office, Donald Trump was asked about further negotiations with Iran.
Plan to just keep bombing until they give up?
There are no signs
What, do you know something that I don't know?
So
what,
talks are
you know
still
something
possible?
That I don't know? Do you know something I don't know?
Well, tell us.
I will tell you. They want to desperately meet. And until they're ready to meet in a meaningful way, we have no interest.
He also signaled that additional attacks are forthcoming, vowing the U.S. would soon strike the area near Pickaxe Mountain, a fortified underground site near one of Iran's nuclear enrichment facilities.
We'll be hitting that area probably pretty soon. Yeah. And there's not a thing they can do about it. You know, normally I wouldn't say that. If I thought they could do something about it, I would never say that. But we'll be hitting that area pretty soon, and very heavily.
Iran has maintained that its nuclear program is peaceful, a statement that was supported by U.S. intelligence. As negotiations remain stalled, the United States and Iran continue exchanging attacks. The U.S. launched another wave of strikes across Iran, while Iran targeted Jordan and infrastructure in neighboring Gulf countries. Both sides have increasingly targeted civilian infrastructure, including energy and desalinization facilities, which is prohibited under international law. UN spokesperson for the Secretary General, Stefan Dujarric, called the attacks unacceptable.
Vital infrastructure on which civilians rely for survival, including hospitals, water supplies, must be spared. All parties must respect their obligations under international humanitarian law, including the principles of distinction, proportionality, and precaution.
Dujarric said the UN is concerned by the escalation, warning that the violence is having a growing humanitarian and economic consequences across the Middle East.
The crisis has already affected Iran, Bahrain, Jordan, Syria, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Qatar, Kuwait, and the United Arab Emirates, placing pressure on trade systems, placing pressure on humanitarian access, on transport costs, and the price of fuel and basic commodities in those countries and beyond. There is no military solution to this conflict, and he calls for intensifying diplomatic efforts towards a peaceful and durable settlement.
The Secretary General also called for the full restoration of international navigational rights around the Strait of Hormuz. The closure of the strait, through which a fifth of the world's oil is traded, has jolted the world's economy, with effects far beyond the Middle East. Earlier today, benchmark Brent crude oil rose to more than $93 a barrel in trading, up from less than $72 earlier this month, which is roughly where it was before the war began. Trump wrote on social media, quote, "From this point forward, anytime the Islamic Republic of Iran shoots at a ship in the Strait of Hormuz, whether it be by missile, rocket, drone, or any other device or weapon, the United States will bomb and destroy one bridge or power plant." Close quote. Trump traveled to Dover Air Force Base in Delaware Wednesday for the arrival of the remains of four U.S. service members, marking the third dignified transfer Trump has attended since he launched the war in Iran in February, the death toll of U.S. service members rising to 18. But speaking to reporters before boarding Air Force One for Delaware, Trump said their sacrifice was unfortunate but necessary.
They said, and all of them said very strongly, we cannot let Iran have a nuclear weapon. They won't have a nuclear weapon. So we're going to honor them. And one of the hardest things to do, for me, it's one of the hardest things to do as a president, but has to be done.
Meanwhile, in Iran, the country's state-run news agency reported explosions across several provinces. Iran's health ministry says U.S. strikes over the past 11 days have killed 53 people, including 6 women and 3 children, and wounded nearly 600 others. Across the conflict, civilian death tolls are estimated at 2,000, although the number may be higher. Iranians who spoke to The Guardian say daily life is becoming increasingly difficult as the war continues and the country's human rights crisis worsens. One 39-year-old resident who spoke anonymously described the combinations of airstrikes, government repression, and water shortages as, quote, "truly hell." Nick Kosar, a U.S.-based Iranian journalist, warned that the attacks on desalinization plants in Iran could have deadly consequences. He told The Guardian, quote, "Attacking desalinization plants in Iran's hot and dry south is particularly dangerous. When temperatures climb above 40 degrees Celsius, losing access to drinking water can quickly become a matter of life and death," close quote. In Minab, relatives buried a small number of newly identified victims Wednesday following the missile strike on the primary school at the start of the war. More than 165 people were killed on February 28th, including more than 100 children. The Minab strike was the deadliest reported attack during the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. Yet, there has been no final accounting of what happened, as the Trump administration has not directly accepted blame, although anonymous sources told the Associated Press that the military possessed evidence almost immediately that the U.S. was to blame. Donald Trump had said the administration would release more information, but both the president and his spokesperson have deflected questions to Defense Secretary Hegseth, who has rarely appeared before the media since the bombing. Despite testifying before the Senate Appropriations Committee Tuesday, he was not pressed by lawmakers on the possible war crime. However, he announced the United States had spent $37.5 billion on the war and is requesting $87 billion more. For KPFA News, I'm Lauren Schmidt.
The House of Representatives today narrowly passed two budget measures meant to fund the war in Iran, fund the military, and provide aid for struggling farmers, and institute some of the priorities of the controversial voting bill known as the SAVE Act. By a 216-214 vote, the House adopted a $95 billion proposal that includes funding for the war in Iran and other White House priorities, including $73 billion for the Pentagon, $12 billion for farmers struggling under President Trump's tariffs, and $10 billion for voting law changes that resemble, again, what is called the SAVE Act. The other measure, known as the National Defense Authorization Act of $1.15 trillion for overall military spending, passed by a 216-212 vote. The bill, among many things, would also officially designate the Department of Defense as the Department of War. Usually this measure has bipartisan support, but not today. The vote was largely over party lines, with most Republicans supporting both military spending measures and most Democrats opposing them, with a handful of Republicans and Democrats voting against their party. Republican Representative Mike Rogers of Alabama, who chairs the House Armed Services Committee, said during today's debate that these funds are necessary to keep the military operating. He also acknowledged, however, that there were many Republicans and Democrats who still have deep concerns about the measures.
For the sake of guaranteeing our freedom well into the future, we need to act now to reverse decades of underinvestment and neglect in our armed forces and our defense industrial base. This bill will do that and much more. It will build the ready, capable, and lethal fighting force we need to deter China and other adversaries. I know there are provisions in this bill that some folks disagree with, but understand that this is just a single step in a long process.
Democratic Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota voted against both military spending bills, saying that they don't reflect the priorities of everyday Americans.
Tens of billion dollars for the Pentagon, billions more for the CIA to continue funding this illegal war with Trump, and billions to help states implement the SAFE Act, legislation that could make it harder for millions of eligible Americans to vote. Meanwhile, working families are struggling to put food on the table, gas in their tanks, pay their rent, and afford health care.
Both the military budget bills as passed in the House today face a difficult path towards final passage that includes the Senate's approval. House Republican leaders are using the budget reconciliation process that could allow the Republican leadership in the Senate to bypass a likely Democratic filibuster. However, some Senate Republicans have expressed concerns over including voting measures that include proof of citizenship to vote to these military spending bills. Senate Republican leaders have refused President Trump's request to eliminate the filibuster when it comes to the so-called SAVE Act. There are also calls by both Democratic and Republican lawmakers for greater transparency from the Trump administration in its war against Iran in return for additional funds. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio spoke at the ASEAN Post-Ministerial Conference in the Philippines today. He started with statements about the war in Iran.
We are open-minded and always willing to engage in negotiated settlements of differences, and that remains true in the case of Iran. Unfortunately, as of now, despite their direct outreaches, and Iran has been reaching out to the United States both directly and indirectly to engage in talks about settling the differences with regards to what's happening in that part of the world. Unfortunately, so far, even though we have reached agreements, they have not kept their commitments.
Rubio said the potential outcomes regarding a toll in the Strait of Hormuz could have ripple effects on other key waterways in the world. Australian Foreign Minister Penny Wong called for an end to the war in the Middle East Wednesday when she spoke on the sidelines of the ASEAN summit in Manila.
We want to see an end to this war. We want to see a ceasefire. We want to see negotiations, and we want the strait to be opened. And
she also committed on the global energy markets.
People are being affected by what is happening and has happened to global energy markets, and that the effect on people has been direct and personal.
Southeast Asia's top diplomats opened 3 days of talks in the Philippines capital on Tuesday with an agenda topped by their most daunting security problems and a backdrop of unfolding crisis led by the resurging U.S.-Iran fighting. Children are relapsing into malnutrition in Nigeria, with local health workers citing ripple effects from the United States' war with Iran. A spike in fuel prices has given way to higher cost of living, and many are struggling to provide for their families. KPFA Youth Works intern Amina Gordon has this report.
The war in Iran will have lasting effects, and not just for those living in the countries directly involved. Northern Nigeria, one of the world's poorest regions, has long been under pressure from armed rebel groups. Now, the conflict in the Middle East has worsened food security for millions of people living in poverty, especially children.
At the same time, Nigerian President Bola Tinubu's vast economic reforms sparked high inflation after fuel subsidies were removed 3 years ago and the Naira, the Nigerian currency, was devalued. A World Bank technical report this week stated that 139 million Nigerians, over half the country's population, are now poor or vulnerable due to poverty. If the war in the Middle East continues, more than 23 million more children could fall into poverty by the end of the year, mainly in Africa and Asia, according to the United Nations Children Agency, UNICEF. During a visit to Nigeria, UNICEF Executive Director Catherine Russell said in the longer term, soaring prices and economic hardship mean that children in poor households are more likely to have stunted growth.
We're already estimating that between 18 and 23 million children will be pushed into poverty, right? So that's a short-term, immediate consequence of what's happening. I think that the challenge short-term is that children are going to be in greater need. They will be hungrier. They will be less likely to get the supplies they need, the immunizations they need. So it'll definitely impact them. For children long-term, what that means is they're more likely to be stunted. Their development will be compromised. They are less likely to stay in school because their parents are under so much financial strain. So the long-term implications for children are absolutely terrible.
Amid the Iran war, the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, through which a fifth of the world's oil passed before the war, sent a ripple effect across the world. A worldwide fuel shock drove up the prices of everything from gas and groceries to fertilizer and airline tickets. Fuel prices in Nigeria jumped from 58 cents per liter in February to $1 in April, with an after effect on the prices of food and necessities. Shehe Aminu, a Nigerian father of six, says his 18-month-old was diagnosed with malnutrition in April. His family's economic struggles grew worse when he lost his job as a taxi driver, a victim of high gasoline prices caused by the war in Iran.
Life used to be good. I worked as a driver and drove a vehicle on hire purchase, making regular payments to the owner. Whenever I returned home, I was able to provide for my family, and we always had enough to eat. But things began to change towards the end of last year. Then, early this year, due to an increase in fuel price, I could no longer keep up with my financial obligations. I now struggle to provide for my family. I had 3 children in an Islamic school, but I couldn't afford to pay their fees, so they had to drop out. When I wake up every morning, it pains me to see my family because I can no longer provide for them the way I used to.
President Donald Trump has been trying to force Iran to fully reopen the Hormuz Strait for months, turning to everything from airstrikes and naval blockades to negotiations and threats. As of today, the strait remains essentially closed, with ongoing effects in Nigeria and beyond.
For KPFA, I'm Amina Gordon.
And you are listening to the Pacifica Evening News on listener-sponsored KPFA in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and KPFK in Los Angeles. I'm Mitch Jezrich, and I will be guest anchoring this news program for these next couple of weeks. And I'm doing it in a time that we come to you during a very important summer fun drive. It's just these few days that we're taking coming to you, asking you for your financial support so that we can continue to bring you the news in this hour. And that's what this program has done forever. It is an institution of the Bay Area, a news institution, bringing voices throughout the world and the community to the air so that you, the listener, can be informed of what is happening in everyday life. I ask for a contribution that you can afford, one that is according to your means and one that you feel good about as you go upon your day. We do have a $1,000 challenge today from both Evelyn and El Cerrito and Jean and Cupertino. Together, they are challenging us to raise $1,000. If we could raise that $1,000 by the end of the hour, that would mean $2,000 for this program today. And that will be important. We did make our challenge yesterday, barely, but we did make it. So I thank those folks who donated yesterday. If you're listening to KPFA or KFCF, the phone number that you are going to call is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 and online at kpfa.org. In Southern California, listening to KPFK in Los Angeles, the number you're going to call is 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735, and online at kpfk.org. As I said, I've been listening to this program for well over 26 years now. In fact, I began, as many people do at this radio station, through our news department, through our news program. That's what happened to me some 26 years ago. And that is what's happening with the reporter of the story that you just heard from Amina Gordon. Amina Gordon just filed that report about Nigerian malnutrition and how it's related to the war in Iran. Amina Gordon is a KPFA Youth Works intern, and I'm very happy to welcome her live to the air right now. Hello, Amina.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Who are you?
As you said, I'm Amina Gordon. I'm a college student living here in Berkeley, and I'm also lucky enough this summer to be one of 3 YouthWorks interns in the newsroom at KPFA.
What are you doing here? What are you doing here? Yes.
Everything. I am coming up with stories that we think are important, writing them, editing them. Editing the audio for them. It's been a lot. I've learned so much, from audio editing skills to news writing skills, research and public speaking. I've always wanted to be a writer. I've always loved writing, but news writing is a completely different beast in itself. So I've been really grateful for this opportunity to dive into that.
Yeah, I remember when I started here as a volunteer reporter 26 years ago, the thing that really stood out to me, the thing that really shocked me when I first got here, was just how much I learned. I mean, about the world, about locally speaking here in the Bay Area, and it was just a sort of real mind-opening experience.
Yeah, definitely. I have felt similarly these past couple of weeks. Specifically, I've been focusing on international stories, as you just talked about, my Nigeria story. And I've learned so much about the entire world that we live in. And it's been really impactful for me to be able to learn myself about what's going on, but also share what I've learned and what's going on with our listeners.
Yeah, you shared a little story with me. I hope you don't mind me bringing it up on air now, but like you're the brainiac now when you go home for dinner with your family.
Yes, exactly. I live in a house of about, well, right now there's 15 of us, all college age, and we have dinner almost every single night. And when we go home, everybody's asking me, what's going on? I heard this guy said this. Is this true? And yeah, they ask great follow-up questions. I have all the answers, which is always a great feeling. And I've really been encouraging them to start listening to the radio.
Yeah, the radio. Fun stuff. You have a radio?
No.
Yeah, I didn't think so. But we have an app. You can listen to us
yes,
online.
I use the app. I'm young, so I use the app.
Good. Well, look, it's thanks to listener contributions that we have a radio station, that we have a news program, and this is why we really want to urge folks to donate to this radio station. We're also asking this hour, along with helping us try to raise this $1,000, if we can get also what we call sustainers to call in. And we have a goal of trying to get three sustainers today. And what that would do is each sustainer would help sponsor one of our young interns who are working here at the radio station. And we got a couple of others, right? We have you.
Yes, me, Lily Owen, who is a Berkeley High student, and also Pearl Petro French, who is also a Berkeley High student.
Yeah. So if somebody could call in, what a sustainer means is that they would give a little bit each month. It could be like $5 a month or $10 a month or $20 a month, whatever is appropriate. And that would be like sponsoring one of our young folks who are coming in and learning how to report and doing reporting, not just learning, but doing it.
Yeah, exactly. As I said earlier, I think radio, sometimes people think of it as kind of an outdated form of media. And so it's been great for the three of us to bring that younger voice to the station. And yeah, so if anybody would like to donate, they can go to kpfa.org or call 1-800-439-5732. And to our listeners in LA tuning in to KPFK, they can call 818-985-5735.
Amina Gordon, a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yep, thank you. Thank you. Amina Gordon, again, she is KPFA Youth Works intern here at Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley. The United States and Saudi Arabia have signed a nuclear cooperation agreement that paves the way for the building of a uranium enrichment facility in Saudi Arabia for its civilian nuclear program. This while the United States is at war with Iran over the pretext to keep Iran from developing its own nuclear weapon. While a uranium enrichment facility does not mean weapons will be developed, it is an early step towards making potential weapons. Nonproliferation advocates warn the deal, known as the 1-2-3 agreement, could lead to a possible nuclear weapons program for the kingdom in the future. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who opposed such a deal as senator, dismissed such concerns today. He said, quote, "The U.S. is not going to reach any agreement with any country in the world that leads to the risk of proliferation." The Trump administration says the agreement includes bilateral safeguards to keep Saudi Arabia from developing its own nuclear weapon. The oil-rich kingdom's energy ministry said the agreement bolsters, quote, "efforts to diversify energy sources, advance cutting-edge technology, and expand opportunities for cooperation and investment in ways that serve the mutual interest of the two friendly countries." However, Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in the past has suggested his country could pursue a nuclear weapon if Iran, its regional rival, obtains an atomic bomb itself. 1-2-3 agreements authorize U.S. companies to sell nuclear technology abroad, and they go into effect unless a veto-proof majority of Congress pass joint resolutions of disapproval. U.S. companies that specialize in nuclear technology stand to make a great deal of money if the agreement goes into effect. Republican lawmakers and the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations took shots at the U.N. today in a hearing on U.N. reforms. Ambassador Mike Waltz told the committee that the U.N. has become a bloated bureaucracy that drifted from its goal. While the Republican committee chair blasted the U.N. as a, quote, "soapbox for terrorists," Democrats, in turn, blasted the Trump administration's cuts and criticisms of the UN. And they also took aim at Ambassador Waltz. Christopher Martinez has more.
The United Nations has long been criticized from many sides, even from within, with Secretary General Antonio Guterres calling for reforms to the Security Council to, for example, boost African representation. But the Trump administration and Republican lawmakers have very different ideas about United Nations reform. And those ideas about the UN were on full display at the House Foreign Affairs Committee Wednesday.
It's become a corrupt, entrenched den of snakes. That's what I would characterize it as.
Republican Brian Mast of Florida is chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He chaired the Wednesday hearing with two U.S. ambassadors to the U.N. as witnesses.
You two men have been asked to show up every day, represent American values, restore sanity to an organization that has grifted off of the American taxpayer and has become a soapbox, literally, for terrorists and America's adversaries.
Mast welcomed Ambassador Waltz and a colleague to the committee. U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Mike Waltz, told the committee he shares the view that the U.N. has drifted badly from its core mission, which he describes as maintaining peace and security around the world.
Unfortunately, the U.N. has tried to become all things to all people and has literally done nothing but grow for its 80-year history. Its budget, just in the last 25 years, has tripled in size, and I don't think we've seen a tripling of peace break out around the world.
He boasted of pressing the UN to cut its budget for the first time ever, as well as slashing the number of UN peacekeepers by one-fourth. But Democrats on the committee did not share Waltz's or the Trump administration's perspective on the UN reforms.
This is not reform, this is retreat.
Gregory Meeks of New York is the ranking Democrat on the committee. He blasted what he called the Trump administration's burn-it-down approach, citing moves to withdraw the U.S. from 69 U.N. agencies, including UNESCO, the Human Rights Council, and the World Health Organization. He says American security and prosperity are strongest when we shape the international system, not abandon it.
The U.N. is not simply a forum for speeches. It is where sanctions are negotiated, peacekeeping missions are authorized, and pandemic responses are coordinated. It's where refugees can help international law, where refugees get help and international law is made. And coalitions are built to meet the shared challenges of our time. No nation, not even the United States of America, can solve these problems alone.
He also made a point about Ambassador Waltz's appointment.
You moved into this job at the UN after a debacle in which you and other senior administration officials text classified war plans to journalists. 16 months later, nothing has changed. The incompetence continues, and it's Americans who keep paying the price.
Democrat Ted Lieu of California also had sharp words about the ambassador.
You don't even know how many U.S. troops were wounded and did in this Iran war. Shame on you for not even know basic facts. You are the U.S. ambassador, and you don't even know how many U.S. troops were wounded in Iran war. You got that wrong. You should be shameful. You don't know basic facts. You should resign.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's new initiative to test and treat service members for low testosterone is raising questions about the Trump administration's ban on transgender troops. U.S. District Judge Anna Reyes on Wednesday asked the administration to explain the medical and logistical differences between providing testosterone replacement therapy to transgender men and offering the same treatment to other service members. The president's policy says military personnel must meet physical and mental health standards without relying on routine medical treatment or special accommodations. Reyes asked the Pentagon to explain why it treats transgender men differently under the military ban while expanding access to testosterone therapy for other troops. Her order came 1 week after Hegseth announced annual testosterone deficiency screenings for service members age 30 and older. Younger troops may volunteer for screening, and treatment would be optional. Washington Democratic Representative Pramila Jayapal accused Hegseth and the administration of hypocrisy.
The Secretary of Forever Wars, Pete Hegseth, said that they are going to provide hormone therapy for male service members who don't have enough testosterone. This, by the way, is gender-affirming care. And by the way, male members of this committee, Watch what you vote for. Do you really want the government getting into your business, taking your testosterone levels, and determining whether or not you have enough testosterone?
Judge Reyes previously ruled that Trump's ban was unlawful. An appeals court partly upheld her order and returned the case for further proceedings. The Supreme Court has allowed the Pentagon to continue enforcing the ban while the litigation proceeds. New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani said late Tuesday that the city does not have the authority to execute an arrest warrant issued for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu by the International Criminal Court. However, he urged the federal government to carry it out. In a video, Mamdani described Netanyahu as a war criminal and said he is not welcomed in New York City.
Benjamin Netanyahu is a war criminal, the architect of a horrific genocide against the Palestinian people. He is responsible for the killing of more than 73,000 people.
Earlier this month, Mamdani told the New York Times that he and the city's legal department were examining whether Netanyahu could be arrested if he travels to New York for the United Nations General Assembly in September.
My administration has reviewed every avenue available under applicable law to determine whether New York City could execute the International Criminal Court's arrest warrant if Benjamin Netanyahu came here. It is clear that we do not have the independent legal authority to enforce this warrant.
President Donald Trump said in a social media post Monday that Netanyahu, quote, will not be arrested in any way, shape, or form while in the United States of America. However, the post did not directly mention Mamdani. Throughout his mayor campaign last year, Mamdani said he would seek to have New York City police arrest Netanyahu under the court's warrant over his role in the war in Gaza. But Mamdani said Tuesday that, after reviewing every available legal avenue, his administration concluded that the city cannot execute the warrant. He said the federal government, however, has the authority to do so.
The federal government, however, does, and I call on them to join the ICC and execute this warrant. And I want to be equally clear. Benjamin Netanyahu is not welcome in New York City, nor is any other war criminal at large. While we cannot end the genocide on our own, we can decide whether our silence will become another weapon.
The International Criminal Court issued arrest warrants for Netanyahu and former Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant in 2024. The court said there were reasonable grounds to believe they bore responsibility for war crimes and crimes against humanity, including using starvation as a method of warfare and intentionally directing attacks against civilians. Israeli officials have denied the allegations. A Jeffrey Epstein-linked modeling scout accused of recruiting women for the convicted pedophile has been found dead at his home near Paris, according to French officials. 69-year-old Daniel Siad was under investigation by French prosecutors specializing in human trafficking. He faced allegations of rape and other offenses, but had not yet been questioned. Siad denied the allegations and said he wanted to prove his account. Or provide his account. His name appeared in more than 1,000 documents included in the Epstein files released by the U.S. Justice Department earlier this year. Records show Siad traveled internationally looking for prospective models as well as women he believed Epstein might want to meet. The documents also show that he remained in frequent contact with Epstein and received money that appeared to cover travel expenses associated with finding women. Siad was found dead Monday evening. French authorities have opened an investigation into the cause of his death, and an autopsy is planned. The once leftist revolutionary Nicaragua's long-serving president, Daniel Ortega, says the country will hold no further elections, declaring that the move is intended to prevent the opposition from coming to power. The 80-year-old authoritarian president first rose to prominence as a leader of the leftist Sandinista National Liberation Front, which overthrew the U.S.-backed dictatorship of Anastasio Somoza in 1979. Ortega has now been in office continuously for nearly two decades. He said he would work with the Congress of his party, who controls, to pass new laws that would, in his words, build a wall against the opposition.
There they are, lying in wait, They wish they could win elections so they could carry out their plans regarding the schools. They should forget about it. There will not be elections here again. There will not be elections again.
No volverán a haber elecciones.
So that they cannot try to seize the government or seize power through that route. And we are going to work with the national assemblies and the appropriate organizations on laws, because laws must be created that put up a wall, a barrier against these coup plotters, against the traitors who sell out their country. And no matter how much money the Yankees give them, they will not be able to do it. They will not be able to do it. They will not be able to do it.
No podrán. No podrán.
Ortega made the announcement Sunday during a ceremony marking the 47th anniversary of the 1979 Sandinista Revolution, in which he helped overthrow the dictatorship of Anastasio Somoza. Although Ortega and his wife and co-president Rosario Murillo have already overseen a steady erosion of democracy, observers are describing the announcement as a significant escalation. Elections have been scheduled for next year, but Ortega did not explain whether they would be canceled outright or whether opposition candidates would be prohibited from participating. During the 2021 election, his government outlawed political parties and jailed all leading opposition presidential candidates. Ortega argued that preventing the opposition from taking power was necessary to protect Nicaragua from what he called coup plotters behind the nationwide protest of 2018. According to United Nations and other organizations, the government's crackdown killed more than 350 people, wounded hundreds, imprisoned thousands, and forced nearly 1 million Nicaraguans into exile. Human Rights Watch says about 50 political prisoners remain in Nicaragua. The government has also stripped 546 people of their citizenship and closed more than 5,600 non-governmental organizations, 29 universities, and 58 media outlets. At today's United Nations briefing, spokesperson Stephanie Dujarric said Secretary General Antonio Guterres is concerned about the continued erosion of political rights and electoral democracy in Nicaragua.
Also, to note, the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, earlier released a statement deploring Nicaragua's deepening restrictions on civil and political freedoms. The Secretary General recalls that authorities have a responsibility to uphold human rights and ensure that all citizens can participate freely and safely in public life, including by exercising their right to vote in elections that guarantee the free expression of the will of the electorate.
UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Volker Turk has also condemned Nicaragua's deepening restrictions on civil and political freedoms. Arizona voters have chosen their nominees as they went to the polls for their primary election yesterday. GOP candidates show that a Trump endorsement is still worth something in that state. Progressive candidates also showed that AIPAC ties don't lead to wins. Teresa Wierzbianska has more.
Arizona voters headed to the polls this week for that state's primary election, where Republicans nominated a slate of candidates who continue to reject or cast doubt on the results of the 2020 presidential election, underscoring President Donald Trump's enduring influence over the state's GOP there. Congressman Andy Biggs won the Republican nomination for governor, defeating fellow Congressman David Schweikert, a longtime Trump ally and former chair of the House Freedom Caucus. Biggs has repeatedly challenged the legitimacy of the 2020 election. Here's Andy Biggs speaking to supporters on election night.
And as we unite and we go out and we work super hard, I have every bit of confidence that we're going to win. We're going to get our message out, our message of restoring the American dream to Arizona, our message of affordability. We have a governor that's taken us from one of the most affordable states to one of the least affordable states.
Biggs will now face Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs, who has frequently been the target of election fraud claims from the political right. Before the polls closed on Tuesday, Hobbs criticized Biggs for refusing to accept the results of her 2022 election victory.
Andy Biggs has spent years undermining confidence in our elections. He still denies the outcome of the 2020 election and refused to certify Arizona's electors, and he still won't admit who won the 2022 governor's race. I'll save him the trouble I did.
Republican voters also nominated State Representative Alexander Colladin for Secretary of State. Colladin, an attorney who represented several of Arizona's so-called, quote, fake electors following the 2020 election, would oversee the state's elections if elected. He'll face Democratic incumbent Adrian Fontes, who has repeatedly defended Arizona's election system against false claims of widespread voter fraud. In another closely watched statewide race, Arizona Senate President Warren Peterson won the Republican nomination for Attorney General. Voters also selected nominees in Arizona's open 1st Congressional District, a suburban swing seat centered around Scottsdale. Republicans view the district as one of their top opportunities after Democratic Congressman Greg Stanton announced he would not seek re-election. Former NFL kicker Jay Feely won the Republican nomination, defeating former state representative Joseph Chaplick after securing President Trump's endorsement. He held a narrow lead over Marlene Galan Woods, though that race had not yet been called as ballots continued to be counted. It was also a notable night for progressive Democrats. Representatives Adelita Grijalva and Elizabeth Lee both won their Democratic primaries after refusing contributions from the pro-Israel lobbying group AIPAC, a position that became a defining issue in their campaigns. Once considered a reliably Republican state, Arizona has become one of the nation's premier battlegrounds, with statewide races often decided by very thin margins. President Trump quickly claimed credit for the Republican victories on his social media platform Truth Social. The results suggest Trump's endorsement remains a powerful force in Arizona Republican politics, but some GOP strategists have warned that continued focus on grievances over the 2020 election could alienate independent voters in a state where general elections are often decided by just a few thousand votes. Democrats currently hold the governor's office, both U.S. Senate seats, and several other statewide offices, setting the stage for another fiercely contested election this November. For Pacifica Radio KPFA, I'm Teresa Wierzbianska.
And you're listening to the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Mitch Jezerich, your guest anchor for the next couple of weeks. I have a quick fundraising update towards that $1,000 challenge that we began earlier in the hours. I speak to you now. We are $565 towards that $1,000 challenge. And we have received a single sustainer so far, Becky in Palo Alto. Becky, see, your monthly contribution is helping one of our young interns here at the news department to continue bringing the news to the air. We are still a little over $400 towards making this $1,000 challenge, and we are trying to get three sustainers. So we have one sustainer in, two more to go. Folks who are willing to donate just a little bit of money every month to help us keep this news program on the air. The phone number is, for KPFA listeners, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. That's also true for KFCF listeners. In Los Angeles, give us a call at 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735, and online at kpfk.org. Wildfires continue to rage across Canada, causing massive air pollution for both Canadians and Americans. President Trump imposes high tariffs on Canadian imports, and new firefighting technology is developed. Pearl Petro French has more.
Nearly 1,000 wildfires are currently burning across Canada. Multiple communities have been ordered to evacuate their homes due to their proximity to the flames, which continue to spread. Most residents are seeking shelter in Thunder Bay, a city in northwestern Ontario, and are sleeping in tents as they wait for the okay to go home. Senior correspondent for CTV News, Heather Wright, details the evacuation scene.
Many of the communities that have had to be evacuated, they are not accessible by road, so they have had to leave by air or in some cases by boats. The community of Holland's First Nation people there saying that they were going door to door trying to make sure no one was left behind.
As of Thursday, the Northwest Territories, Quebec and Ontario are the three most impacted areas with almost 200 active wildfires, only 10 of which are now contained. The air quality in Canada, New England, and the Great Lakes regions of the U.S. are severely affected. Air quality officials released a report on Monday showing that over 10 major cities have been ranked unhealthy and very unhealthy. Winds are causing the heavy smoke to move south into the U.S., leaving the states struggling to go about daily life. Chicago, Illinois has been hit especially hard, receiving an IQ air rank of 153 within the unhealthy range, when the general public may experience health effects and children, older adults, and people with heart or lung conditions may face greater risks. There is no single cause for these fires. Multiple factors like drier than usual conditions due to climate change, lightning, and some human activity contributed to the widespread blaze. At least 15 fires so far have been classified as human-caused, though whether they were accidental or intentional is not yet known to the public. Lightning isn't an uncommon cause for wildfires in Canada, and the wildfires themselves aren't uncommon either. Wildfires were once a natural and frequent part of the landscape, but decades of fire suppression allowed vegetation to accumulate, contributing to larger and more destructive fires. With rising temperatures attributed to global warming, Canadian vegetation is extremely dry, which is the perfect foundation for fast-spreading flames. On top of that, lots of the fires are in very remote, uninhabited parts of the country and can't be reached just by roads, creating the perfect storm for uncontrollable wildfires. Environment Canada senior climatologist David Phillips explains the struggle to put the flames out.
These fires are so intense that you almost can't fight them. You almost have to move people away from the fire zone, and you even water bombers can't do it. It's almost you need weather. I mean, weather caused many of them, and weather has to put them out.
Monday afternoon, President Donald Trump announced that starting August 19th, 50% tariffs will be imposed on some Canadian goods which come as he has expressed irritation about the situation and suggested that Canada could pay for the damage done here in the U.S.
I told them, you got to stop these fires from coming in and, you know, poisoning our air. Our air has been poisoned. I have a good relationship with Mark Carney, but, you know, we got to stop the fires up there. If we can help them, we'll help them. But maybe they should pay us some damages or something, or we should do some tariffs.
Meanwhile, California Governor Gavin Newsom offers a rebuttal.
Not lost on me that the President of the United States just imposed a 50% tariff to increase your costs. To increase your costs, because he said that Canada didn't do enough to rake their forests. That was just promoted by the president yesterday.
Closer to home, 15 wildfires are currently active across California, contributing to more than 144,000 acres burned in the state so far this year. Governor Gavin Newsom and the leaders of CAL FIRE, the California Natural Resources Agency, and the Governor's Office of Emergency Services are expected to highlight the state's investments in wildfire protection and firefighting technology.
From modeling software that quickly provides prediction and fire spread, to upgraded aircraft with a larger payload, to mountaintop cameras with AI technology.
These new tools aim to make response times faster by improving early detection, preventing fires, and reducing the ones that have already started. For KPFA News, I'm Pearl Petro-French, YouthWorks intern.
In Alameda County, a wildfire broke out Tuesday evening east of Interstate 680, roughly between Pleasanton and Livermore. As of this broadcast, the little fire has burned 1,007 acres and is 40% contained. CAL FIRE reports that the fire's forward progress has been stopped while crews continue strengthening containment lines. One firefighter suffered minor injuries when a CAL FIRE engine rolled over. Firefighter was taken to a hospital and has since been released. Two evacuation orders remain in effect, covering a largely uninhabited area east of the Caleb Preserve golf course. This year's World Cup tournament may be over, but the controversies certainly are not. Some are calling for Gianni Infantino to resign as the head of FIFA. Lily Owen has more.
After the final whistle, Madrid erupted into celebrations with thousands of supporters pouring into the streets from bars and restaurants, many draped in Spanish flags or wearing the team's colors. Crowds packed the capital's Puerta del Sol and other major squares, singing, dancing, and setting off flares with car horns blared. Many celebrated Sunday's victory long into the wee hours of Monday morning. The men's victory, combined with the Women's World Cup won by Spain in 2023, makes the European nation the first to hold both titles simultaneously. Fans were absolutely stunned across all platforms after a photo surfaced by photographer Joan Monfort of the star of the Spain vs. Argentina winning game, Lamine Yamal as a baby being bathed by 20-year-old Lionel Messi back in 2007. Now those images of long-haired Messi, his hands covered in soap suds, after anointing Yamal as soccer's next big thing, have become the most talked about and gawked about in Sunday's World Cup final, when Messi's Argentina played Yamal's Spain for the biggest trophy in the sport. The attention turned during the post-game trophy presentation when President Donald Trump was escorted onto the pitch by Gianni Infantino into a chorus of boos. After he handed over the medals, he simply could not step off the stage and out of the spotlight. Even after Infantino strongly persuaded him, Trump caught criticism online and immediately supporters jumped to his defense, saying that he had every right to stand there given his position as World Cup host leader.
And that was a report by Lily Owen, another one of our young interns reporting here in our news department. And you are listening to the Pacifica Evening News. I'm the ghost anchor. Actually, guest anchor is what I meant to say. And I'm going to be with you over the next couple of weeks. And I want to let you know where we are towards that $1,000 challenge that came from Evelyn in El Cerrito. And Gene and Cupertino, as I speak to you right now, we are $890 towards that $1,000 challenge. We are $110 away from making it. If we can make it, that will turn this hour and our fundraising efforts this hour into $2,000. It will mean doubling your donation, and we are almost there. We've had one person so far call in as a sustainer. We're trying to also get three sustainers this hour, and what sustaining means is that every month you give what you can. It could be $5, $15, $30. It could be even more, but really what's appropriate for you and what you do. And the way we're doing this is today we had three interns working on the broadcast, and we're hoping we get a sustainer for each intern we have here as sort of a sponsor for each of the interns. You heard from Amina Gordon a little bit earlier. The phone number is for KPFA listeners and KFCF listeners, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. And for our friends in Southern California listening to KPFK in Los Angeles, the number you call is 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735, and online at kpfk.org. As I said, I am Mitch Jesrich. I'm very happy to be joined now by the KPFA News Director who puts on this broadcast and oversees this broadcast each night, Lauren Schmidt. Good evening, Lauren.
Hi, Mitch. Good evening.
You're also engineering, I should point out. You're doing many things.
I'm pressing some buttons over here.
You're the first report we aired on tonight's broadcast as well.
Well, in the true spirit of grassroots independent media, we do it because we love it and because KPFA, we exist to bring our communities independent facts and unfiltered truth. And hot off the press, we actually have our second out of three sustainers for our goal. Thank you to Jackson in Studio City who made the pledge to support this program, this incredible internship program we offer at KPFA. The last two voices you heard, Pearl Petro French and Lily Owen, are like Amina. They are also our youth works interns. And I don't know if I've ever been more proud in my life. Lily and Pearl are actually go to Berklee High School, and they've spent their summer here learning how to become blossoming journalists. I truly get emotional working with these kiddos. I've learned so much from them, as much as they've probably learned from us. And when you donate during this 6 o'clock Pacifica News hour, your donation goes towards that, keeping their young voices on the air. It is a part of the critical mission we have here at KPFA, which is why we're asking you to call 800-439-5732. That's 800 800 Hey KPFA, or by going online to kpfa.org, where you can make a safe and secure donation. You know, Mitch, you've stated you kind of cut your teeth actually as an intern here in the newsroom with the legendary Eileen Alfandary and Mark Miracle. I call her Eileen, the news queen.
I think she was the greatest journalist I've ever known.
And it's big shoes to fill, but it's an honor and a privilege I take extremely seriously. And we're going to continue to train the next generation of journalists, the next Mitch Jezerich and the next Aminas. And we're just so excited to be a part of this and offer this to.
I came from Houston, Texas, moved out to L.A. for work and school. I found out about KPFK by turning on local radio. And it's nice to listen to the sister station out here.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, asking you to support KPFK.